Natural Living with Gary Null, exploring the nature and politics of medicine, health, nutrition, and the environment. And now your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. Today, continuation of our ongoing, in-depth investigative reporting series on deconstructing the myth of AIDS. This is offering people an alternative opinion, a different perspective. This is part two today. In part one, I began by challenging the whole idea of science by press conference, that there was not a well-defined scientific debate, discussion, and analysis of this hypothesis that HIV could be the sole and exclusive cause of 29 different infections that we've had for over a century, many of them. Today I'll continue. Also, I'll be sharing some of the latest articles that generally are not well read or even understood. They exist by the mainstream medical community, and if they did and looked at these articles, could give them a different perspective. The average scientist, unless directly involved in AIDS research, does not have the time nor energy to carefully study all the controversies in scientific literature. This is certainly excusable and understandable. However, what is culpable is moving from an acknowledgement of one's limited knowledge to an unquestioning acceptance of the current opinion simply because everybody believes it. This is nothing more than herd mentality. I interviewed Dr. Charles Thomas about this, and he spoke about the equation of HIV equals AIDS equals death, and that is the mantra for the scientific and media information going out to the public. It is exactly this view, he points out, that is held by anyone of the top 200, 400, or 500 most prestigious scientists in America. However, he said, this view is not based upon knowledge, but ignorance. If you put one of these guys on the spot and ask them, have you actually looked into all these points? They would have to say, if they were honest, no, I haven't. Of course they haven't. They haven't the time. This is an easy out, Thomas notes, since they actually did look into it at one point, but superficially, never at depth. They simply looked as far as what the official position was. HIV equals AIDS equals death. Of course, any idea will be readily accepted as scientific truth if it comes from the mainstream. It will have to be one that jibes with the current paradigm. Before turning to that topic, however, let us add one last caution about modern science. We have tried to suggest thus far that many scientific speculations have been illegitimately promoted to truth by the media, and gullible or overworked scientists have gone along with them. Mr. and Mrs. Average Reader may say, this is impossible. Modern science is not subject to that type of quackery that ruled in the 19th century when people believed in pseudosciences and alchemy. Our age is too skeptical and too enlightened. Well, Dave Rasnick has usefully pointed out that pseudoscience, like voodoo economics, is still very much with us. He recalls the hoopla around cold fusion, which became a fad among reputable scientists. Not too many years ago, two scientists in Utah claimed to have produced nuclear fission in a laboratory bench, in essence a controlled hydrogen bomb. The media trumpeted the discovery before other physicists could replicate the experiment. The same was true of the AIDS virus. HIV is to medicine what cold fusion was to physics. Both the AIDS virus and cold fusion were unleashed upon the world during hastily called press conferences and received intense international coverage. Previously unknown scientists, though respected in their fields, of course, were regrettably transformed during primetime television into celebrities. Sadly, none of those gentlemen were prepared for what lay ahead. The perpetrators of cold fusion and HIV are either embroiled in litigation or have other legal problems and have generally become quite embattled in all of the scrutiny and controversy that has come up around them. Dr. Bernard Forsher, formerly managing editor of the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, was so disheartened by the way AIDS research is being played to the media and to the scientific peers that he said, quote, "It is a hoax that has become a scam," unquote. For the remainder of this program, I'm going to go into how AIDS as a hypothesis so neatly fits into your doctor's predilections. Before going there, I would like to bring you up to date on some of the other opinions of dissenting physicians and scientists, and some of the latest things occurring that we are generally not made aware of. I'm going to quote an article by Michael Wright, as published originally in the San Francisco Chronicle, May 24, 2000. "As a former AIDS research grant recipient, I wish to praise South African President Mbeki for his courage in having publicly declared his willingness to listen to scientists who challenge the AIDS orthodoxy. For 9 years, beginning in 1997, I was involved professionally in AIDS HIV research. During the 1990s, I was awarded 2 federal grants for this work by the Small Business Innovation Research Program and the U.S. National Cancer Institute. By the end of this period, I had become skeptical about official beliefs concerning AIDS. My project was to design computer software that assessed risk for current HIV infection. And after computing the probability of infection by incorporating the anonymous user's answers into a detailed history interview conducted in privacy, the software makes a recommendation about whether the individual should have an HIV antibody test. In order to win these grants, I had to review the epidemiological literature to arrive at plausible measures of HIV transmission risk for different kinds of sexual conduct and at reasonable estimates of HIV infection prevalence within various U.S. population groups. From this research, I concluded that there was absolutely no reason to fear a heterosexual HIV epidemic sustained by the presence or practice of vaginal sex in the United States." Let me repeat that, because this is very important. This is what one of the leading researchers in the field came up with. "There was absolutely, quote, no reason to fear a heterosexual HIV epidemic sustained by the practice of vaginal sex in the United States. Although numerous studies have demonstrated the enormously low possibility of a heterosexual HIV epidemic, the Center for Disease Control chose to ignore them and launched a fraudulent campaign of fear to convince the majority of American public that sexually active people are at significant risk of contracting HIV. The scare campaign was initiated in the late 1980s and was nothing more than a political strategy to stir up popular support for elevated government spending for various AIDS programs, including pursuit of the elusive dream of miracle cures. Pharmaceutical companies have enjoyed handsome benefits from this endeavor and now seek to expand their enterprises in South Africa and other third world nations. There is a large body of literature which supports the conclusions that the possibility of a heterosexual HIV epidemic is enormously low." In one of the more honest moments of reporting by the mainstream American press, the Wall Street Journal exposed the political nature of the scare campaign in a long article published on May 1, 1996. The journal described the creation of the CDC's, quote, marketing campaign, unquote, to spread the belief in universality of risk for AIDS. The article reported that federal funding for AIDS-related medical research grew to $1.6 billion in 1996 from $341 million in 1987, while the CDC's prevention dollars grew to $584 million from $136 million. Interestingly, as shown by the CDC's own published numbers, the HIV prevalence within the vast population they were intending to frighten was actually declining as the scare propaganda was escalated. As I observed the growing credibility gap between the perception manufactured by the scare campaigners and the reality described in the scientific press, I became open to the arguments attacking other elements in the officially promoted belief system about AIDS. In plain terms, one might ask, If they would lie as shamelessly as they have about heterosexual risk, could they have be trusted to be honest about other aspects of AIDS? Dr. Robert Root Bernstein, a Michigan State physiologist and the author of Rethinking AIDS, was the first skeptical writer to influence me to begin questioning the view that HIV is the sole cause of AIDS. In a Wall Street Journal guest editorial, March 17, 1993, he pointed out that AIDS had remained within the specific risk groups, gay men and an ever-growing population of urban, drug-addicted, poverty-ridden, malnourished, hopelessly, and medically deprived people, unquote. Root Bernstein further emphasized that those who suffer from AIDS, quote, have many additional immune suppressive factors at work for them that predispose them to disease, unquote. His list of examples included semen-induced autoimmunity following unprotected anal sex, blood transfusions, multiple concurrent infections, both recreational and pharmaceutical drug use, malnutrition, and anemia. His position was that HIV does not explain AIDS in the absence of cofactors. It followed that eliminating the other risk factors is the plausible strategy of combating AIDS, instead of treating with toxic antiviral drugs. In the foreword of Inventing the AIDS Virus by prominent AIDS researcher and dissident Peter Duisberg, Nobel laureate Carrie Mullis reports his failure to discover a single scientific publication demonstrating that HIV is the cause of AIDS. The official definition of AIDS has been an evolving political drama whose script has been written by bureaucratic operatives scheming on maximizing advantage for their agencies. In the United States, there have been four official AIDS definitions since 1983. Dr. Duisberg says, quote, every time the CDC needs higher rates of new AIDS cases, it expands that definition once again, and more diseases are reclassified into the syndrome. In Africa, an altogether different definition is used, created by the World Health Organization. It does not even require the presence of HIV be detected in order to diagnose an AIDS case. Given the state of affairs, a more plausible statement of a tenable scientific hypothesis would be, what factors explain serious illness and death in those who have been labeled AIDS patients? Are there, on published record, any cases of such patients for whom all proposed causes of immunosuppression other than HIV have been contradicted by evidence? By Michael Wright. Very important statement. Because there you have someone from the heart of the AIDS research community coming forward and saying, it's merely a political ploy. It's been done, by the way, by the military-industrial complex. Just imagine this. During the Cold War, no one questioned how much was being spent on military defense because of our capacity to offer first strike and deterrence. Well, we don't have a Cold War issue now with Russia or China. And yet, our Cold War spending has been dwarfed by our peacetime spending. And no one seems to question that, as if every year we have to continue to increase our military spending. Does anyone ever ask, what is it actually spent for? Do we really need it? How much is redundant? How much goes to military industrial contractors and their enormous profit bases with interlocking connections to the military and industrial Pentagon and Defense Department? Well, similarly, this is also true within the cancer establishment, and when the National Cancer Institute said, well, if it's a virus, then all the research went into virus. Then it was shown the cancer wasn't a virus. So we must keep in mind what he is saying is that look for the idea that these agencies want more money, and if we get scared into believing that we are all equally susceptible to AIDS, then we'll give them money. This is an article written by Dr. Roberto Giraldo, medical doctor. And I'm going to quote it verbatim. I think it's extremely interesting because following the article, he has almost 100 references. I've gone through these references. I've cross-checked them against my own research, and they are all valid. So everything that he is stating now, there is a peer-reviewed journal to support, even though it may not seem that way. But if he makes a statement, and then you look back at the reference, and it's the Immunology Toxicology Drug and Chemical Toxicology Review, gives a citation. So here it is. The transmission of AIDS from person to person is a myth. The homosexual transmission of AIDS in Western countries, as well as the heterosexual transmission of AIDS in Africa and in other undeveloped countries, is an assumption without any scientific validation. There is no logic or scientific explanation for AIDS to be mostly, quote, transmitted homosexually in the West and heterosexually in poor countries. The sexual transmission of AIDS has been assumed based upon high frequency by which AIDS occurs on drug-addicted gay males in the developed countries and by the similar frequency of the syndrome in both sexes within the underdeveloped countries. Whenever there is an outbreak of a new disease, the first question to answer is, what are the new circumstances surrounding the individuals who are getting the new illness? In the report of the first five cases of AIDS to the CDC by Michael Gottlieb in June 1981, he informed, quote, four had serologic evidence of past hepatitis B infection. Two of the five reported having frequent homosexual contacts with various partners. All five patients had laboratory-confirmed cytomegalovirus disease or virus shedding within 5 months of the diagnosis of pneumocystis carinii pneumonia. All five reported using inhalant drugs, and one reported using patent drugs at an abuse level. And that's a citation. So let me stop for a moment. Focus on this. What he is saying is, when you have a new disease, what's changed? And go back to the first five cases of AIDS reported to the CDC by Dr. Michael Gottlieb. And suddenly we start saying, if we look at this, and I'm quoting what he's citing, and it's an actual citation from Dr. Gottlieb, that it is all based upon the drug use. All of these individuals were substantially on using, they had been infected with hepatitis B, they had cytomegalovirus, they had pneumocystis carinii pneumonia, they'd been using, all five had been regularly using amyl nitrate on a regular basis. Now, does that sound like your average person? Your average gay? No. Your average heterosexual? No. A fast-track gay or a fast-track homosexual? Yes. What percentage of the population do they represent? Under 2%. So then we could, if we were honest, say that the original diagnosis of AIDS in these men were based upon their lifestyle, not a virus. There's no virus, HIV virus, here yet. This is all in the lifestyle. I'll go on to continue reporting. I'll quote, there is nothing in this report that could suggest a sexually transmitted germ as the cause of the new condition. Homosexuality has existed forever. The new evidence, the new circumstance around the people who were getting a collapse of their immune systems was the use of drugs by some members of the gay community in the U.S. and Europe that began in the late 60s and early 70s. The toxic character of AIDS can be seen since the very first report of the new syndrome. There was not a need for a microbe to be the cause of the new toxic condition. However, the CDC decided in the editorial note to comment Gallup's report that, quote, the fact that these patients were all homosexual suggests an association between some aspect of homosexual lifestyle or disease acquired through sexual contact and pneumocystis carinii pneumonia in this population, unquote. Even long before HIV was discovered and proposed as the cause of AIDS, the U.S. Public Health Service decided the contagious character of the new syndrome. On November 5, 1992, the CDC wrote, quote, AIDS, precautions for clinical and laboratory staffs. 4 months later, the CDC, together with the Food and Drug Administration and the National Institutes of Health, regulated the prevention of AIDS as if it were an infectious and transmittable disease. They decided that AIDS was infectious and sexually transmitted without having any scientific evidence or proof whatsoever. In his recent book, Dr. Luc Montagnier confesses, quote, "It was in 1982 that AIDS began to capture the attention of researchers. By that time, we knew, by the number of reported cases among homosexuals, that we were dealing with a communicable disease," unquote. Robert Gallo, writing upon, quote, "the AIDS virus 1987, accuses, quote, AIDS is probably the result of a new infection of human beings that began in Central Africa, perhaps as recently as the 1950s. It appears that the virus has had more time to spread in Africa than it has in other parts of the world," unquote. Regarding the so-called T. lymphotropic virus 3 of African green tree monkeys, he said, quote, "A plausible hypothesis is that this virus somehow entered human beings, initiating a series of mutations that yielded the intermediate viruses before terminating in the fierce pathology of HTLV-3. That's according to Robert Gallo's Scientific America, 1987, unquote. The above are supposedly scientific basis for the infection and contagious view upon AIDS. Researchers in the institutions searching for the cause of AIDS in the early 1980s, and that still are the ones that make the policies for AIDS worldwide, seem to ignore that there exist epidemics of toxic diseases, epidemics of nutritional diseases, epidemics of high blood pressure, epidemics of cancer, epidemics of mental illness, epidemics of allergies. They can only think about epidemics of infectious diseases. Also, it seems as if they all ignored that regular diseases can affect gay people. These researchers and their institutions are impregnated with a microbiological prejudice by which all disease should be caused by germs. Gallo and Montagnier have both spent most of their lives searching for the virus that causes cancer. They have not found it. It is not necessary to make emphasis in the ethnic and sexual prejudices also expressed by the above statements. The world was prepared throughout a century of panic to the microbes and by other prejudices to commit the mistake about the etiology of AIDS. There was no way to avoid it. Similar errors have been committed with the pellagra, beriberi, and scurvy, to mention just a few examples. Logically, this time the consequences of the mistake are much more tragic. All individuals on Earth have sexual activity. Similarly, all people eat or sleep. The epidemiological correlation of AIDS with sexual life as well as with eating and sleeping is perfect. Therefore, in the same way that it is said that AIDS is sexually transmitted, it can be said that it is transmitted through eating or sleeping. During the last decades, the new circumstances surrounding gay males who develop AIDS in the West are their exposure throughout their lifestyle to drugs of abuse and other immunological stressors. In the West, AIDS is mostly confined to male homosexuals because they are more frequently exposed to immunological stressor agents, not because they're homosexual preferences. Homosexuality has always existed. However, in the late 60s and early 70s, gay male people in the United States and Europe introduced drugs and aphrodisiacs into their lifestyles. On the other side, the new circumstances surrounding individuals of both sexes in the poorest countries of Africa, Asia, and the Caribbean are their involuntary exposure to the never-before-seen high levels of poverty, malnutrition, unsanitary conditions, infections, and parasites. Here, both sexes are equally exposed to immunological stressor agents. Therefore, in these countries, the risk of AIDS is equal for both genders. The perinatal transmission of AIDS from mother to child during pregnancy and delivery, as well as the postnatal transmission throughout breast milk, are also myths without any scientific validation. Both mothers and infants who react positively on the HIV test or who develop AIDS do so to exposures to immunological stressor agents. Currently, humans, animals, and plants on Earth are all suffering from some level of immune suppression due to multiple repeated and chronic exposure to the alarming worldwide increment of immunological stressor agents, which can have a chemical, physical, biological, mental, or nutritional origin. Immunodeficiency is pandemic. Individuals can be exposed to immunological stressors involuntarily through their conditions of life and voluntarily through their lifestyles. AIDS is the worst possible immunological human condition. If the course of AIDS is not stopped, it will eventually cause the death of the individual. Besides, AIDS is the tip of an iceberg. Below AIDS, there are many other mild to moderate immunodeficiencies with or without clinical manifestation. AIDS began in the second half of the last century, at a moment when the immune system of humans are already saturated and cannot tolerate more challenges and aggravations. AIDS is an alarm bell for an endangered species. However, HIV does not permit the real danger to be seen and the proper measures to be taken. The increasing epidemic of AIDS in underdeveloped countries of Africa and Asia is demanding strong measures to be taken before populations of these countries vanish. In the 70s, a new medical science was born, immunotoxicology, which studies the effects of toxicants that can poison the immune system. Around 30 years ago, immunologists began to be preoccupied by the increasing amount of new immunosuppressive conditions that animals and humans were suffering due to voluntary and involuntary exposures to a great variety of substances and materials. Similarly, during the last few decades, and due to the alarming worldwide increase in stressor agents affecting the human ecosystem, new medical sciences have had to be created. Dermatotoxicology, genotoxicology, neurotoxicology, endocrinology toxicology, and cardiotoxicology, and hepatotoxicology. We may pay attention to this and take the necessary actions to guarantee the future of our species. We ought to stop panicking about germs. Currently, the real problems are toxicants, poverty, and malnutrition. And of course, then what follows are all the footnotes that everything that I've just read from this man, this physician, is completely supported by an enormous amount of careful scientific literature documents. Now, let me put this in a little different perspective. What he is saying, and it makes so much sense, is this. If we claim that there is now an epidemic of AIDS in Africa and that it's spread sexually and it's infectious, and that's been the case since the beginning, then all you have to do, and you do not have to be a scientist or an epidemiologist to do this, take the map of Africa and put on it an overlap of all of the AIDS hotspots. You will see that the AIDS hotspots from the very beginning of this so-called epidemic is the same today. Now, knowing that there's enormous migration between countries and travel, then if you have an infectious epidemic, every single city, town, community, hamlet, every place in Africa should be equally contagious. It is not. You have whole countries in Africa that have zero probability of having an AIDS epidemic. They don't. Now, what makes them different? Well, one of the things is you don't have it in the heterosexual community of whites. What do you mean? You have whites and blacks, both heterosexual, living in a country. The blacks have an epidemic of it, like in South Africa, and the whites do not. Then you have to separate out by education and income. So let's say that in South Africa you have a large population of blacks who are poor, who do not have food. The government doesn't have a proper infrastructure for subsidizing clean water and clean food and housing. There's enormous 65% unemployment, and these people live under chronic stress. Those blacks are considered at epidemic level for AIDS. Now, other blacks who are able to work within the middle class bureaucracy, who have food, water, housing, and less stress, they don't have an AIDS epidemic. And the affluent blacks, those who through their own determinants have been able to exceed what would be considered an economic expectation for an African in their own country, they have zero AIDS. Now, common sense, all right? If you say that an HIV virus and sexual transmission is infecting, then why is it the whites aren't infected? The affluent whites aren't infected. The affluent blacks are not infected. The middle class is not infected. And all research shows it is only those people suffering from some very specific lifestyle. The lifestyle is not sexual. It is based upon gross malnutrition, chronic stress, all forms of parasite, contaminated drinking water, no hygiene, and migration. The highest levels of AIDS are recorded in those people who are in population groups that have been caught up in civil war. Isn't it interesting? In those countries in Africa that did not have civil war, you do not have an epidemic of AIDS. You don't have a pandemic. It's not even a blip. Now, but if you're really doing true and honest science, you would say, if you have an infectious disease, everyone is equally susceptible. If you're saying you have a heterosexual disease, then you'd have to say everyone's equally susceptible. And then you would say, you mean two middle-class blacks and two wealthy blacks are less likely to transmit the virus between them as two poor blacks. The idea then is, well, of course, poor blacks are having sex with everyone. No, not true. Not true. There is a very high moral and ethical standard in blacks, irrespective of their economics, something our elitist CDC has failed to recognize, and the World Health Organization, which is partly responsible for the enormous amount of immunosuppression. Interestingly enough, if you take the original cases of AIDS in Africa and lay a map over, which I have done with Dr. Seals in London, and when I went to visit him, and he was the one who first pointed this out, and then Neville Hodgkinson laid this out in the Times of London in a startling revelation, that the only epicenters of AIDS in Africa were exactly where the contaminated smallpox vaccine was given to over 120 million individuals. Interesting. Those people did not get the smallpox vaccine. You don't see it. So when you subtract the fact that we do not have an AIDS epidemic in Africa, it cannot be shown to be sexually transmitted. You have interview after interview and proof after proof of people who have been completely and totally monogamous, who have never been unfaithful, and they both end up coming down with what is called AIDS because they suffer from wasting disease, chronic infections, unproductive cough, and diarrhea. And then we say it was sexually transmitted, and the World Health Organization sends a $60,000 Land Rover out with a box of condoms and big posters saying safe sex saves your life. These people have no food. They have no water. They have no future. And we're giving them condoms. That's the mindset of the bureaucracy in AIDS. If you're going to apply the rules of science, apply them properly. Otherwise, it's fraudulent. And virtually everything you have ever read about AIDS is a lie. Everything. There is no AIDS epidemic in Africa. There never has been. What there is in an epidemic is tuberculosis, malnutrition, gross starvation, 60 million Africans without adequate food and nourishment, 150 million Africans without proper water, and those are the ones that we will consider proper candidates for the Clinton, Gore, give them AZT, and if you don't, you will have an embargo, and that's the reason that Mbeki, the courageous president of South Africa, had to do a turnaround and start introducing the idea that pregnant women should be given, even forced to be given, AZT. AZT is a known DNA terminator. It kills cells. You want to know why Ryan White died? AZT. Kimberly Bergalis, AZT. And most of the other people with AIDS, AZT. Sooner or later, mark my words, the world will know that as a fact. But not now, because there's too many AIDS organizations. There's too many individuals who are now benefiting from the enormous funding that's going on. In my new documentary, which you will see interviews from over 16 countries in Africa, you will see this phenomena. You will see doctors who are there at the so-called epicenter of the AIDS epidemic who will tell you that the moment people are fed and given proper medications for their known diseases like tuberculosis or malaria, they get well. And then they're no longer diagnosed as AIDS. Well, if they had AIDS, just giving them proper nutrition wouldn't change anything, based upon what we're told about this killing virus. So we will continue after station identification, when I will give you some of what happens in America before I continue on my report of a now a HIV case reporting and partner notification law. They now want to make it mandatory that anyone who has been diagnosed as HIV positive must go through a whole series of tests and be required to take medication, and you must notify everyone you've ever had sex with, and then you go on lists. Is this the next step before being quarantined? Charles Ortlieb, a leading AIDS educator, activist, courageous publisher of the New York Native, and the one who brought us the information along with Nina Ostrom, the award-winning reporter, that we didn't have an epidemic of AIDS, we had an epidemic of HIV 6, human herpes 6, says that it is his belief, looking at the current laws, that we are about in the next stage of preparing for mandatory quarantining of anyone who tests positive. And by the way, what is the criteria for testing positive? The new laws, as they're being interpreted, would mean that you do not have to have an HIV positive test if you simply have a low T cell. Now, who has a low T cell? Low enough to be considered as AIDS, chronic fatigue syndrome, marathon runners, people with cancer, people with autoimmune diseases, people under chronic stress. What a great category for the CDC. Change the criteria that you no longer have to have HIV, just low T cell count, below 200, and you'll probably capture another 60 million Americans who have low T cells, which of course means nothing, but to them, it means everything. And that bill is right here now. I'm Gary Knoll, back in a moment to continue part two, our special investigative report, Deconstructing the Myth of AIDS. Show to go here, and our final day of fundraising. I want to thank everyone yesterday. I didn't get the final tally, but when I called in last, it was at 8,100, and I'm not sure how much higher it went than that. Fellas, do you know?
Not a clue. I think it must have been close to 10.
Yeah, the phones were ringing really so wildly at that moment that we couldn't get you an accurate tally at that time.
So we may have hit close to 10,000 yesterday.
Yes, very, very possible.
And today is our final day.
Yes, it is.
And let me explain. There's not going to be an opportunity after today to get these three premiums. 30 Steps to De-Stress in Your Life, which, by the way, I had 60 people take the video. I gave them the video in a focus group, and I asked them, take it home for the next 30 days, apply the information, and tell me what your response is. And the response we got, we started getting all the responses back yesterday. The responses were phenomenal, absolutely phenomenal, and of what it meant and how people have been able to change their stress levels, their anger levels, their rage levels, their sublimation levels. One guy has lost over 22 pounds in the last 32 days because he said that he used to, the moment he got stressed, he'd eat. And he'd always eat junk foods. And pizzas were his favorite thing. He said he'd down 2-3 pizzas in a day if he got stressed. And he was a computer operator. He is a computer operator. And he didn't like his work. He didn't like the environment which he was working. Worked in a little tiny cubby hole. And because he had a rather quiet and self-effacing personality, he had never really stand up for himself. So if you ask him how he was doing, he'd say, okay. And so after watching 30 steps to de-stress in your life about how you affirm what's important to you and focusing each day on honoring what you really want and who you are so you don't have to be angry, he just made up a whole list of the things he'd like to see change. And lo and behold, he said when he presented it to his boss, they agreed. He says now he's in front of a window. His hours are changed. He was able to bring some plants in and put them. And he's no longer have to work the night shift. He said he had been doing that for 14 years because he never assumed that anything could change because of what he thought were the heavy-handed practices in his office. All he did was ask. He said he felt so good, so empowered, that he no longer felt stressed just coming to work. So he stopped sublimating. So his acne, his skin is cleared up, he said, and his he's lost weight, and he's feeling good. And now he's going out to exercise each day. That's just one of the people, the feedback. Now, I haven't read all of them because I didn't finish work last night till about 10 after 4 this morning. And I've been working nonstop because I'm preparing. I had to finish up. No, I actually finish up next week. I have one more week to go on the BAI finishes today, but other stations are not finished until next week. But I'm finishing working on this screenplay that we're filming next Wednesday night, and it's going to be very important. Anyhow, I read about seven, and the seven that I read were very, very positive. One person was chronically having problems in her relationship, feeling that she was unappreciated, her real needs not being met, and yet she was insecure about challenging what was wrong in the relationship. And then she started taking notes. And she mentioned specific numbers of the 30 steps, which steps dealt with how to communicate better what you're feeling without getting angry in the process. And don't share your emotions. Just stay neutral and share what you consider the facts of it. And she said when she did that, then the other person in her relationship didn't get all bent out of shape and things got resolved. And she feels really good that now she's very happy with the direction the relationship is in. That's all from the 30 steps. So the 30 steps to de-stressing your life, the book, The Food, Mood, Body Connection, and the other book, The Complete Encyclopedia of Natural Healing. In the next hour, that's it. Because in January, I have a new book, new video. In April, I have a new book, new video. In September, I have a new book, new video. I work a year in advance, sometimes 2 years in advance. And over, I have my next five books and my next five videos all planned. And they're all different and all unique. So you better get up to date so you can keep ahead because all this just keeps adding to the body of knowledge and your resources for health and healing. So we're looking forward to going out in a big bang today. And I also want to mention that Roy of Hollywood, I was on there between, this is the dead hour. He normally doesn't raise funds between 2:30 and 4 o'clock in the morning. Just, he says, we'd raise $50. The normal rate is sometimes $200. We broke all records in the history of KPFK. In that short period of time, right in the middle of the night in Los Angeles, $15,000. $15,000 on our sister station in the middle of the night at like 3 o'clock in the morning. So they were very happy about that. So I've done that. They're finished. Don't have to do that anymore. And yesterday, when we knocked the socks off the previous tallies down in Washington, which, and by the way, using the same premiums. And the big, it's kind of interesting because I like to see if you get the same. Who's listening? What do they see their needs to be? And in Los Angeles, it wasn't 30 Steps to De-stressing. It was the encyclopedia. In Washington, it was the food mood. In New York, it's stress because we're under so much stress. At every level, we're stressed. There's wonderful reasons to live in New York. I love New York. But I also realize that it costs a lot of money to live here. You better enjoy the culture that's here because if you don't, then there's no point in living here. That's what makes it unique, the diversity of people, the diversity of ideas, the diversity of cultures coming together, and the uniqueness of our wonderful creative community the creative communities makes us special, just like Taos, New Mexico makes it special. But Taos doesn't have the excitement New York has. It has the art, but doesn't have the excitement. Here we have it all. But there's an enormous amount of stress here. So that's the one that people are really going for, because they're going to use this over and over and over and over and over again. Also, the food, move, body connection has been very popular. So I just want to let you know, today is the last day to get this stuff. Then it is gone. I'm already focusing. When you come around last, if you were in my studio any day this week when I wasn't teaching, wasn't counseling, we were filming every day. And this week we're filming. And in fact, yesterday I was doing so many things. I was supposed to be up filming this this conference up in Westchester, and I'm pretty sure no one from my office went up to film it. Just too many things to film and on low level radiation. Too many things to film and too few people to do it. So, but we're getting a lot done. And by the way, for those of you, this is a complete aside. And it's my own personal opinion. Does not represent that of the station or anyone else. But I feel it's necessary to share this. I'm working very diligently to try to help redirect what I consider the essential needs, not just to the Green Party, but to expand that so that over the next 4 years, major issues that are not being addressed, have not been addressed by any of the primary candidates, can be, so that the younger people in America can take a look at what's important to them also. The issues have been overly narrowly defined. Almost everything you hear is Social Security or drugs for senior citizens. Those are not the most important issues in America today. And we're not paying attention to the real issues. And people calling themselves environmental candidate this, environmental candidate that, and then you look at the records and you look at the facts. Just look at the facts and you see anything, but they're absolutely not. People talk about being an expert on foreign policy, and then you see what they have done in Russia to destroy the entire Russian average person's lives by our rush to